It is critical to remember that, at their core, firefighters are also desperately trying to protect the system. Unlike managers, who are usually superficially cooperative during therapy, firefighters don't hold back. They hurl insults and storm out of the room. Firefighters are frantic, and if you ask them what would happen if they stopped doing their job, you discover that they believe the exiled feelings would crash the entire self-system. They are also oblivious to the idea that there are better ways to guarantee physical and emotional safety. And even if behaviors like binging or cutting stop, firefighters often find other methods of self-harm. These cycles will come to an end only when the self is able to take charge and the system feels safe. The burden of toxicity. Exiles are the toxic waste dump of the system. Because they hold the memories, sensations, beliefs, and emotions associated with trauma, it's hazardous to release them. They contain the, "Oh my God, I'm done for," experience, the essence of inescapable shock, and with it, terror, collapse, and accommodation. Exiles may reveal themselves in the form of crushing physical sensations or extreme numbing, and they offend both the reasonableness of the managers and the bravado of the firefighters. Like most incest survivors, Joan hated her exiles, particularly the little girl who had responded to her abuser's sexual demands and the terrified child who whimpered alone in her bed. When exiles overwhelm managers, they take us over. We are nothing but that rejected, weak, unloved, and abandoned child. The self becomes blended with the exiles, and every possible alternative for our life is eclipsed. Then, as Schwartz points out, we see ourselves and the world through their eyes and believe it is the world. In this state, it won't occur to us that we have been hijacked. Keeping the exiles locked up, however, stamps out not only memories and emotions, but also the parts that hold them, the parts that were hurt the most by the trauma. In Schwartz's words, usually those are your most sensitive, creative, intimacy-loving, lively, playful, and innocent parts. By exiling them when they get hurt, they suffer a double whammy. The insult of your rejection is added to their original injury. As Joan discovered, keeping the exiles hidden and despised was condemning her to a life without intimacy or genuine joy. Unlocking the past. Several months into Joan's treatment, we again accessed the exiled girl who carried the humiliation, confusion, and shame of Joan's molestation. By then she had come to trust me enough and had developed enough sense of self to be able to tolerate observing herself as a child, with all her long-buried feelings of terror, excitement, surrender, and complicity. She did not say very much during this process, and my main job was to keep her in a state of calm self-observation. She often had the impulse to pull away in disgust and horror, leaving this unacceptable child alone in her misery. At these points, I asked her protectors to step back so that she could keep listening to what her little girl wanted her to know. Finally, with my encouragement, she was able to rush into the scene and take the girl away with her to a safe place. She firmly told her abuser that she would never let him get close to her again. Instead of denying the child, she played an active role in liberating her. As in EMDR, the resolution of the trauma was the result of her ability to access her imagination and rework the scenes in which she had become frozen so long ago. Helpless passivity was replaced by determined, self-led action. Once Joan started to own her impulses and behaviors, she recognized the emptiness of her relationship with her husband, Brian, and began to insist on change. I invited her to ask Brian to meet with us, and she was present for 8 sessions before he began to see me individually. Schwartz observes that IFS can help family members mentor each other as they learn to observe how one person's parts interact with another's. I witnessed this firsthand with Joan and Brian. Brian was initially quite proud of having put up with Joan's behavior for so long, feeling that she really needed him, had kept him from even considering divorce. But now that she wanted more intimacy, he felt pressured and inadequate, revealing a panicked part that blanked out and put up a wall against feeling. Gradually, Brian began to talk about growing up in an alcoholic family, where behaviors like Joan's were common and largely ignored, punctuated by his father's stays in detox centers and his mother's long hospitalizations for depression and suicide attempts. When I asked his panicked part what would happen if it allowed Brian to feel anything, he revealed his fear of being overwhelmed by pain, the pain of his childhood added to the pain of his relationship with Joan. Over the next few weeks, other parts emerged. First came a protector that was frightened of women and determined never to let Brian become vulnerable to their manipulations. Then we discovered a strong caretaker part that had looked after his mother and his younger siblings. This part gave Brian a feeling of self-worth and purpose, and a way of dealing with his own terror. Finally, Brian was ready to meet his exile, the scared, essentially motherless child, who had no one to care for him. This is a very short version of a long exploration, which involved many diversions, as when Joan's critic reemerged from time to time. But from the beginning, IFS helped Joan and Brian hear themselves and each other from the perspective of an objective, curious, and compassionate self. They were no longer locked in the past, and a whole range of new possibilities opened up for them. The Power of Self-Compassion, IFS and the Treatment of Rheumatoid Arthritis. Nancy Shattuck is a rheumatologist at Boston's Brigham and Women's Hospital, who combines medical research on rheumatoid arthritis, known as RA, with a strong interest in her patients' personal experience of their illness. When she discovered IFS at a workshop with Richard Schwartz, she decided to incorporate the therapy into a study of psychosocial intervention with RA patients. RA is an autoimmune disease that causes inflammatory disorders throughout the body, causing chronic pain and disability. Medication can delay its progress and relieve some of the pain, but there is no cure, and living with RA can lead to depression, anxiety, isolation, and overall impaired quality of life. I followed this study with particular interest because of the link I'd observed between trauma and autoimmune disease. Working with senior IFS therapist Nancy Sowell, Dr. Shattuck created a 9-month randomized study in which one group of RA patients would receive both group and individual instruction in IFS, while a control group received regular mailings and phone calls regarding disease symptoms and management. Both groups continued with their regular medications, and they were assessed periodically by rheumatologists who were not informed which group they belonged to. The goal of the IFS group was to teach patients how to accept and understand their inevitable fear, hopelessness, and anger, and to treat those feelings as members of their own internal family. They would learn the inner dialogue skills that would enable them to recognize their pain, identify the accompanying thoughts and emotions, and then approach these internal states with interest and compassion. A basic problem emerged early. Like so many trauma survivors, the RA patients were alexithymic. As Nancy Sowell later told me, they never complained about their pain or disability unless they were totally overwhelmed. Asked how they were feeling, they almost always replied, "I'm fine." Their stoic parts clearly helped them cope, but these managers also kept them in a state of denial. Some shut out their bodily sensations and emotions to the extent that they could not collaborate effectively with their doctors. To get things moving, the leaders introduced the IFS parts dramatically, rearranging furniture and props to represent managers, exiles, and firefighters. Over the course of several weeks, group members began to talk about the managers who told them to grin and bear it because no one wanted to hear about their pain anyway. Then, as they asked the stoic parts to step back, they started to acknowledge the angry part that wanted to yell and wreak havoc, the part that wanted to stay in bed all the time, and the exile who felt worthless because she wasn't allowed to talk, It emerged that, as children, nearly all of them were supposed to be seen and not heard. Safety meant keeping their needs under wraps. Individual IFS therapy helped patients apply the language of parts to daily issues. For example, one woman felt trapped by conflicts at her job, where a manager part insisted the only way out was to overwork until her RA flared up. With a therapist's help, she realized that she could care for her needs without making herself sick. The two groups, IFS and controls, were evaluated 3 times during the 9-month study period and then again 1 year later. At the end of 9 months, the IFS group showed measurable improvements in self-assessed joint pain, physical function, self-compassion, and overall pain relative to the education group. They also showed significant improvements in depression and self-efficacy. The IFS group's gains in pain perception and depressive symptoms were sustained 1 year later, although objective medical tests could no longer detect measurable improvements in pain or function. In other words, what had changed most was the patient's ability to live with their disease. In their conclusions, Shattuck and Soule emphasized IFS's focus on self-compassion as a key factor. This was not the first study to show that psychological interventions can help RA patients. Cognitive behavioral therapies and mindfulness based on practices have also been shown to have a positive impact on pain, joint inflammation, physical disability, and depression. However, none of these studies has asked a crucial question. Are increased psychological safety and comfort reflected in a better functioning immune system? Liberating the Exiled Child. Peter ran an oncology service at a prestigious academic medical center that was consistently rated as one of the best in the country. As he sat in my office in perfect physical shape because of his regular squash practice, his confidence had crossed the line into arrogance. This man certainly did not seem to suffer from PTSD. He told me he just wanted to know how he could help his wife to be less touchy. She had threatened to leave him unless he did something about what she termed his callous behavior. Peter assured me that her perception was warped, because he obviously had no problem being empathetic with sick people. He loved to talk about his work, proud of the fact that residents and fellows competed fiercely to be on his service, and also of scuttlebutt he'd heard about his staff being terrified of him. He described himself as brutally honest, a real scientist, someone who just looked at the facts and, with a meaningful glance in my direction, did not suffer fools gladly. He had high standards, but no higher than he had for himself, and he assured me that he didn't need anybody's love, just their respect. Peter also told me that his psychiatry rotation in med school had convinced him that psychiatrists still practiced witchcraft, and his one stint in couples therapy had further confirmed that opinion. He expressed contempt for people who blamed their parents or society for their problems. Even though he had had his own share of misery as a child, he was determined never to think of himself as a victim. While Peter's toughness and his love for precision appealed to me, I couldn't help but wonder if we would discover something I'd seen all too often. That internal managers who are obsessed with power are usually created as a bulwark against feeling helpless. When I asked him about his family, Peter told me that his father ran a manufacturing business. He was a Holocaust survivor who could be brutal and exacting, but he also had a tender and sentimental side that had kept Peter connected with him and that had inspired Peter to become a physician. As he told me about his mother, he realized for the first time that she had substituted rigorous housekeeping for genuine care. But Peter denied that this bothered him. He went to school and got straight A's. He had vowed to build a life free of rejection and humiliation, but, ironically, he lived with death and rejection every day. Death on the oncology ward, and the constant struggle to get his research funded and published. Peter's wife joined us for the next meeting. She described how he criticized her incessantly. Her taste in clothes, her child-rearing practices, her reading habits, her intelligence, her friends. He was rarely at home and never emotionally available. Because he had so many important obligations and because he was so explosive, his family always tiptoed around him. She was determined to leave him and start a new life unless he made some radical changes. At that point, for the first time, I saw Peter become obviously distressed. He assured me and his wife that he wanted to work things out. At our next session, I asked him to let his body relax, close his eyes, focus his attention inside, and ask that critical part, the one his wife had identified, what it was afraid would happen if he stopped his ruthless judging. After about 30 seconds, he said he felt stupid talking to himself. He didn't want to try some New Age gimmick. He'd come to me looking for empirically verified therapy. I assured him that, like him, I was at the forefront of empirically based therapies, and that this was one of them. He was silent for perhaps a minute before he whispered, "I would get hurt." I urged him to ask the critic what that meant. Still with his eyes closed, Peter replied, "If you criticize others, they don't dare to hurt you. Then, if you are perfect, nobody can criticize you." I asked him to thank his critic for protecting him against hurt and humiliation. And as he became silent again, I could see his shoulders relax and his breathing become slower and deeper. He next told me that he was aware that his pomposity was affecting his relationships with his colleagues and students. He felt lonely and despised during staff meetings and uncomfortable at hospital parties. When I asked him if he wanted to change the way that angry part threatened people, he replied that he did. I then asked him where it was located in his body, and he found it in the middle of his chest. Keeping his focus inside, I asked him how he felt toward it. He said it made him scared. Next, I asked him to stay focused on it and see how he felt toward it now. He said he was curious to know more about it. I asked him how old it was. He said about 7. I asked him to have his critic show him what he protected. After a lengthy silence, still with his eyes closed, he told me that he was witnessing a scene from his childhood. His father was beating a little boy, him, and he was standing to one side thinking how stupid that kid was to provoke his dad. When I asked him how he felt about the boy who was getting hurt, he told me that he despised him. He was a weakling and a whiner. After showing even the least bit of defiance to his dad's high-handed ways, he inevitably capitulated and whimpered that he would be a good little boy. He had no guts, no fire in his belly. I asked the critic if he would be willing to step aside so we could see what was going on with that boy. In response, the critic appeared in full force and called him names like wimp and sissy. I asked Peter again if the critic would be willing to step aside and give the boy a chance to speak. He shut down completely and left the session saying that he was unlikely ever to set foot in my office again. But the following week he was back. As she had threatened, his wife had gone to a lawyer and filed for divorce. He was devastated and no longer looked anything like the perfectly put-together doctor whom I'd come to know and, in many ways, dread. Faced with the loss of his family, he became unhinged and felt comforted by the idea that if things got too bad, he could take his life in his own hands. We went inside again and identified the part that was terrified of abandonment. Once he was in mindful self-state, I urged him to ask that terrified boy to show him the burdens he was carrying. Again, his first reaction was disgust at the boy's weakness. But after I asked him to get that part to step back, he saw an image of himself as a young boy in his parents' house, alone in his room, screaming in terror. Peter watched this scene for several minutes, weeping silently through most of it. I asked him if the boy had told him everything he wanted him to know. No, there were other scenes, like running to embrace his father at the door and getting slapped for having disobeyed his mother. From time to time, he would interrupt the process by explaining why his parents couldn't have done any better than they had, there being Holocaust survivors and all that implied. Again, I suggested he find the protective parts that were interrupting the witnessing of the boy's pain and request that they move temporarily to another room. And each time he was able to return to his grief. I asked Peter to tell the boy that he now understood how bad the experience had been. He sat in a long, sad silence. Then I asked him to show the boy that he cared about him. After some coaxing, he put his arms around the boy. I was surprised that this seemingly harsh and callous man knew exactly how to take care of him. Then, after some time, I urged Peter to go back into the scene and take the boy away with him. Peter imagined himself confronting his dad as a grown man, telling him, "If you ever mess with that boy again, I'll come and kill you." He then, in his imagination, took the child to a beautiful campground he knew, where the boy could play and frolic with ponies while he watched over him. Our work was not done. After his wife rescinded her threat of divorce, some of his old habits returned, and we had to revisit that isolated boy from time to time to make sure that Peter's wounded parts were taken care of, especially when he felt hurt by something that had happened at home or on the job. This is the stage IFS calls unburdening, and it corresponds to nursing those exiled parts back to health. With each new unburdening, Peter's once scathing inner critic relaxed, as little by little it became more like a mentor than a judge, and he began to repair his relationships with his family and colleagues. He also stopped suffering from tension headaches. One day he told me that he'd spent his adulthood trying to let go of his past, and he remarked how ironic it was that he had to get closer to it in order to let it go. Chapter 18. Filling in the Holes. Creating Structures. The greatest discovery of my generation is that human beings can alter their lives by altering their attitudes of mind. William James. It is not that something different is seen, but that one sees differently. It is as though the spatial act of seeing were changed by a new dimension. Carl Jung. It is one thing to process memories of trauma, but it is an entirely different matter to confront the inner void, the holes in the soul that result from not having been wanted, not having been seen, and not having been allowed to speak the truth. If your parents' faces never lit up when they looked at you, it's hard to know what it feels like to be loved and cherished. If you come from an incomprehensible world filled with secrecy and fear, it's almost impossible to find the words to express what you have endured. If you grew up unwanted and ignored, it is a major challenge to develop a visceral sense of agency and self-worth. The research that Judy Herman, Chris Perry, and I had done, which I spoke about in Chapter 9, showed that people who felt unwanted as children, and those who did not remember feeling safe with anyone while growing up, did not fully benefit from conventional psychotherapy, presumably because they could not activate old traces of feeling cared for. I could see this even in some of my most committed and articulate patients. Despite their hard work in therapy and their share of personal and professional accomplishments, they could not erase the devastating imprints of a mother who was too depressed to notice them, or a father who treated them like he wished they'd never been born. It was clear that their lives would change fundamentally only if they could reconstruct those implicit maps. But how? How can we help people become viscerally acquainted with feelings that were lacking early in their lives? I glimpsed a possible answer when I attended the founding conference of the United States Association for Body Psychotherapy in June 1994 at a small college in Beverly, on the Rocky, Massachusetts coast. Ironically, I had been asked to represent mainstream psychiatry at the meeting and to speak on using brain scans to visualize mental states. But as soon as I walked into the lobby, where attendees had gathered for morning coffee, I realized this was a different crowd from my usual psychopharmacological or psychotherapy gatherings. The way they talked to one another, their postures and gestures, radiated vitality and engagement, the sort of physical reciprocity that is the essence of attunement. I soon struck up a conversation with Albert Pesso, a stocky former dancer with the Martha Graham Dance Company, who was then in his early 70s. Underneath his bushy eyebrows, he exuded kindness and confidence. He told me that he had found a way of fundamentally changing people's relationship to their core, somatic selves. His enthusiasm was infectious, but I was skeptical and asked him if he was certain he could change the settings of the amygdala. Unfazed by the fact that nobody had ever tested his method scientifically, he confidently assured me that he could. Pesso was about to conduct a workshop in PBSP psychomotor therapy, and he invited me to attend. It was unlike any group work I had ever seen. He took a low chair opposite a woman named Nancy, whom he called a protagonist, with the other participants seated on pillows around them. He then invited Nancy to talk about what was troubling her, occasionally using her pauses to witness what he was observing, as in, "A witness can see how crestfallen you are when you talk about your father deserting the family." I was impressed by how carefully he tracked subtle shifts in body posture, facial expression, tone of voice, and eye gaze, the nonverbal expressions of emotion. This is called micro-tracking in psychomotor therapy. Each time Pesso made a witness statement, Nancy's face and body relaxed a bit, as if she felt comforted by being seen and validated. His quiet comments seemed to bolster her courage to continue to go deeper. When Nancy started to cry, he observed that nobody should have to bear so much pain all by herself, and he asked if she would like to choose someone to sit next to her. He called this a contact person. Nancy nodded, and after carefully scanning the room, pointed to a kind-looking middle-aged woman. Pesso asked Nancy where she would like her contact person to sit. "Right here," Nancy said decisively, indicating a pillow immediately to her right. I was fascinated. People process spatial relations with the right hemisphere of the brain, and our neuroimaging research had shown that the imprint of trauma is principally on the right hemisphere as well. Caring, disapproval, and indifference are all primarily conveyed by facial expression, tone of voice, and physical movements. According to recent research, up to 90% of human communication occurs in the nonverbal right hemisphere realm, and this is where Pesso's work seemed primarily to be directed. As the workshop went on, I was also struck by how the contact person's presence seemed to help Nancy tolerate the painful experiences she was dredging up. But what was most unusual was how Pesso created tableaus, or, as he called them, structures of the protagonist's past. As the narratives unfolded, group participants were asked to play the roles of significant people in the protagonist's lives, such as parents and other family members, so that their inner world began to take form in three-dimensional space. Group members were also enlisted to play the ideal, wished-for parents who would provide the support, love, and protection that had been lacking at critical moments. Protagonists became the directors of their own plays, creating around them the past they never had. And they clearly experienced profound physical and mental relief after these imaginary scenarios. Could this technique instill imprints of safety and comfort alongside those of terror and abandonment, decades after the original shaping of mind and brain? Intrigued with the promise of Pesso's work, I eagerly accepted his invitation to visit his hilltop farmhouse in southern New Hampshire. After lunch beneath an ancient oak tree, Al asked me to join him in his red clapboard barn, now a studio, to do a structure. I'd spent several years in psychoanalysis, so I did not expect any major revelations. I was a settled, professional man in my 40s with my own family, and I thought of my parents as two elderly people who were trying to create a decent old age for themselves. I certainly did not think they still had a major influence on me. Since there were no other people available for role play, Al began by asking me to select an object or a piece of furniture to represent my father. I chose a gigantic black leather couch and asked Al to put it upright about 8 feet in front of me, slightly to my left. Then he asked if I'd like to bring my mother into the room as well, and I chose a heavy lamp approximately the same height as the upright couch. As the session continued, the space became populated with the important people in my life. My best friend, a tiny Kleenex box to my right. My wife, a small pillow next to him. My two children, two more tiny pillows. After a while, I surveyed the projection of my internal landscape. Two hulking, dark, and threatening objects, representing my parents, and an array of minuscule objects, representing my wife, children, and friends. I was astounded. I had recreated my inner image of my stern, Calvinistic parents from the time I was a little boy. My chest felt tight, and I'm sure that my voice sounded even tighter. I couldn't deny what my spatial brain was revealing. The structure had allowed me to visualize my implicit map of the world. When I told Al what I had just uncovered, he nodded and asked if I would allow him to change my perspective. I felt my skepticism return, but I liked Al and was curious about his method, so I hesitantly agreed. He then interposed his body directly between me and the couch and lamp, making them disappear from my line of sight. Instantaneously, I felt a deep release in my body. The constriction in my chest eased, and my breathing became relaxed. That was the moment I decided to become Peso's student. Restructuring inner maps. Projecting your inner world into the three-dimensional space of a structure enables you to see what's happening in the theater of your mind and gives you a much clearer perspective on your reactions to people and events in the past. As you position placeholders for the important people in your life, you may be surprised by the unexpected memories, thoughts, and emotions that come up. You then can experiment with moving the pieces around on the external chessboard that you've created and see what effect it has on you. Although the structures involve dialogue, psychomotor therapy does not explain or interpret the past. Instead, it allows you to feel what you felt back then, to visualize what you saw, and to say what you could not say when it actually happened. It's as if you could go back into the movie of your life and rewrite the crucial scenes. You can direct the role players to do things they failed to do in the past, such as keeping your father from beating up your mom. These tableaus can stimulate powerful emotions. For example, as you place your real mother in the corner, cowering in terror, you may feel a deep longing to protect her and realize how powerless you felt as a child. But if you then create an ideal mother who stands up to your father and who knows how to avoid getting trapped in abusive relationships, you may experience a visceral sense of relief and an unburdening of that old guilt and helplessness. Or you might confront the brother who brutalized you as a child and then create an ideal brother who protects you and becomes your role model. The job of the director, therapist, and other group members is to provide protagonists with the support they need to delve into whatever they have been too afraid to explore on their own. The safety of the group allows you to notice things that you have hidden from yourself, usually the things you are most ashamed of. When you no longer have to hide, the structure allows you to place the shame where it belongs, on the figures right in front of you who represent those who hurt you and made you feel helpless as a child. Feeling safe means you can say things to your father, or rather the placeholder who represents him, that you wish you could have said as a 5-year-old. You can tell the placeholder for your depressed and frightened mother how terrible you felt about not being able to take care of her. You can experiment with distance and proximity and explore what happens as you move placeholders around. As an active participant, you can lose yourself in a scene in a way you cannot when you simply tell a story. And as you take charge of representing the reality of your experience, the witness keeps you company, reflecting the changes in your posture, facial expression, and tone of voice. In my experience, physically re-experiencing the past in the present and then reworking it in a safe and supportive container can be powerful enough to create new, supplemental memories. Simulated experiences of growing up in an attuned, affectionate setting where you are protected from harm. Structures do not erase bad memories or even neutralize them the way EMDR does. Instead, a structure offers fresh options, an alternative memory in which your basic human needs are met and your longings for love and protection are fulfilled. Revising the past. Let me give an example from a workshop I led not long ago at the Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California. Maria was a slender, athletic Filipina in her mid-40s who had been pleasant and accommodating during our first 2 days, which had been devoted to exploring the long-term impact of trauma and teaching self-regulation techniques. But now, seated on her pillow about 6 feet away from me, she looked scared and collapsed. I wondered to myself if she had volunteered as a protagonist mainly to please the girlfriend who had accompanied her to the workshop. I began by encouraging her to notice what was going on inside her and to share whatever came to mind. After a long silence, she said, "I can't really feel anything in my body and my mind is blank." Mirroring her inner tension, I replied, "A witness can see how worried you are that your mind is blank and you don't feel anything after volunteering to do a structure. Is that right?" "Yes," she answered, sounding slightly relieved. The witness figure enters the structure at the very beginning and takes the role of an accepting, non-judgmental observer who joins the protagonist by reflecting his or her emotional state and noting the context in which that state has emerged, as when I mentioned Maria's volunteering to do a structure. Being validated by feeling heard and seen is a precondition for feeling safe, which is critical when we explore the dangerous territory of trauma and abandonment. A neuroimaging study has shown that when people hear a statement that mirrors their inner state, the right amygdala momentarily lights up, as if to underline the accuracy of the reflection. I encouraged Maria to keep focusing on her breath, one of the exercises we had been practicing together, and to notice what she was feeling in her body. After another long silence, she hesitantly began to speak. "There is always a sense of fear in everything I do. It doesn't look like I'm afraid, but I am always pushing myself. It is really difficult for me to be up here." I reflected, "A witness can see how uncomfortable you feel pushing yourself to be here." And she nodded, slightly straightening her spine, signaling that she felt understood. She continued, "I grew up thinking that my family was normal, but I always was terrified of my dad. I never felt cared for by him. He never hit me as hard as he did my siblings, but I have a pervasive sense of fear." I noted that a witness could see how afraid she looked as she spoke of her father, and then I invited her to select a group member to represent him. Maria scanned the room and chose Scott, a gentle video producer who had been a lively and supportive member of the group. I gave Scott his script. "I enroll as your real father, who terrified you when you were a little girl," which he repeated. Note that this work is not about improvisation, but about accurately enacting the dialogue and directions provided by the witness and protagonist. I then asked Maria where she would like her real father to be positioned. And she instructed Scott to stand about 12 feet away, slightly to her right and facing away from her. We were beginning to create the tableau, and every time I conduct a structure, I'm impressed by how precise the outward projections of the right hemisphere are. Protagonists always know exactly where the various characters in their structures should be located. It also surprises me, again and again, how the placeholders representing the significant people in the protagonist's past almost immediately assume a virtual reality. The people who enroll seem to become the people he or she had to deal with back then, not only to the protagonist, but often to the other participants as well. I encouraged Maria to take a good, long look at her real father, and as she gazed at him standing there, we could witness how her emotions shifted from terror to to a deep sense of compassion for him. She tearfully reflected on how difficult his life had been. How, as a child during World War II, he had seen people beheaded. How he had been forced to eat rotten fish infested with maggots. Structures promote one of the essential conditions for deep therapeutic change. A trance-like state in which multiple realities can live side by side, past and present, knowing that you're an adult while feeling the way you did as a child, expressing your rage or terror to someone who feels like your abuser while being fully aware that you are talking to Scott, who is nothing like your real father, and experiencing simultaneously the complex emotions of loyalty, tenderness, rage, and longing that kids feel with their parents. As Maria began to speak about their relationship when she was a little girl, I continued to mirror her expressions. Her father had brutalized her mother, she said. He was relentlessly critical of her diet, her body, her housekeeping, and she was always afraid for her mother when he berated her. Maria described her mother as loving and warm. She could not have survived without her. She would always be there to comfort Maria after her father lashed out at her. But she didn't do anything to protect her children from her father's rage. I think my mom had a lot of fear herself. I have a sense that she didn't protect us because she felt trapped. At this point, I suggested that it was time to call Maria's real mother into the room. Maria scanned the group and smiled brightly as she asked Kristen, a blonde, Scandinavian-looking artist, to play the role of her real mother. Kristen accepted in the formal words of the structure. I enroll as your real mother, who was warm and loving, and without whom you would not have survived, but who failed to protect you from your abusive father. Maria had her sit on a pillow to her right, much closer than her real father. I encouraged Maria to look at Kristen and then asked, "So what happens when you look at her?" Maria angrily said, "Nothing." A witness would see how you stiffen as you look at your real mom, and angrily say that you feel nothing, I noted. After a long silence, I asked again, "So, what happens now?" Maria looked slightly more collapsed and repeated, "Nothing." I asked her, "Is there something you want to say to your mom?" Finally, Maria said, "I know you did the best you could," and then moments later, "I wanted you to protect me." When she began to cry softly, I asked her, "What is happening inside?" "Holding my chest, my heart feels like it is pounding really hard," Maria said. "My sadness goes out to my mom, how incapable she was of standing up to my father and protecting us. She just shuts down, pretending everything's okay, and in her mind it probably is, and that makes me mad today. I want to say to her, 'Mom, when I see you react to Dad when he is being mean, when I see your face, you look disgusted, and I don't know why you don't say, fuck off. You don't know how to fight. You are such a pushover. There is a part of you that is not good and not alive. I don't even know what I want you to say. I just want you to be different. Nothing you do is right. Like you accept everything when it is totally not okay.' I noted, 'A witness would see how fierce you are as you want your mother to stand up to your dad.' Maria then talked about how she wanted her mother to run off with the kids and take them away from her terrifying father. I then suggested enrolling another group member to represent her ideal mother. Maria scanned the room again and chose Ellen, a therapist and martial artist. Maria placed her on a pillow to her right between her real mother and herself and asked Ellen to put her arm around her. "What do you want your ideal mother to say to your dad?" I asked. "I want her to say, 'If you are going to talk like that, I am going to leave you and take the kids,' she answered. 'We are not going to sit here and listen to this shit.'" Ellen repeated Maria's words. Then I asked, "What happens now?" Maria responded, "I like it. I have a little pressure in my head. My breath is free. I have a subtle energetic dance in my body now. Sweet." "A witness can see how delighted you are when you hear your mother saying that she's not taking this shit from your dad anymore, and that she will take you away from him, I told her. Maria began to sob and said, I would have been able to be a safe, happy little girl. Out of the corner of my eye, I could see several group members weeping silently. The possibility of growing up safe and happy clearly resonated with their own longings. After a while, I suggested that it was time to summon Maria's ideal father. I could clearly see the delight in Maria's eyes as she scanned the group, imagining her ideal father. She finally chose Danny. I gave him his script, and he gently told her, I enroll as your ideal father, who would have loved you and cared for you, and would have not have terrified you. Maria instructed him to take a seat near her on her left and beamed. My healthy mom and dad, she exclaimed. I responded, Allow yourself to feel that joy as you look at an ideal dad who would have cared for you. Maria cried, It's beautiful, and threw her arms around Danny, smiling at him through her tears. I am remembering a really tender moment with my dad, and that is what this feels like. I would love to have my mom next to me, too. Both ideal parents tenderly responded and cradled her. I left them there for a while so that they could fully internalize the experience. We finished with Danny saying, If I'd been your ideal dad back then, I would have loved you just like this and not have inflicted my cruelty. While Ellen added, If I'd been your ideal mom, I would have stood up for you and me, and protected you and not let any harm come to you. All the characters then made final statements, de-enrolling from the roles they had played, and formally resuming being themselves. Rescripting your life. Nobody grows up under ideal circumstances, as if we even know what ideal circumstances are. As my late friend David Servan Schreiber once said, every life is difficult in its own way. But we do know that in order to become self-confident and capable adults, it helps enormously to have grown up with steady and predictable parents. Parents who delighted in you, in your discoveries and explorations. Parents who helped you organize your comings and goings, and who served as role models for self-care and getting along with other people. Defects in any of these areas are likely to manifest themselves later in life. A child who has been ignored or chronically humiliated is likely to lack self-respect. Children who have not been allowed to assert themselves will probably have difficulty standing up for themselves as adults. And most grown-ups who were brutalized as children carry a smoldering rage that will take a great deal of energy to contain. Our relationships will suffer as well. The more early pain and deprivation we have experienced, the more likely we are to interpret other people's actions as being directed against us, and the less understanding we will be of their struggles, insecurities, and concerns. If we cannot appreciate the complexity of their lives, we may see anything they do as a confirmation that we are going to get hurt and disappointed. In the chapters on the biology of trauma, we saw how trauma and abandonment disconnect people from their bodies as a source of pleasure and comfort, or even as a part of themselves that needs care and nurturance. When we cannot rely on our body to signal safety or warning, and instead feel chronically overwhelmed by physical stirrings, we lose the capacity to feel at home in our own skin and, by extension, in the world. As long as their map of the world is based on trauma, abuse, and neglect, people are likely to seek shortcuts to oblivion. Anticipating rejection, ridicule, and deprivation, they are reluctant to try out new options, certain that these will lead to failure. This lack of experimentation traps people in a matrix of fear, isolation, and scarcity, where it's impossible to welcome the very experiences that might change their basic worldview. This is one reason the highly structured experiences of psychomotor therapy are so valuable. Participants can safely project their inner reality into a space filled with real people, where they can explore the cacophony and confusion of the past. This leads to concrete aha moments, such as, yes, that's what it was like. That is what I had to deal with. And that is what it would have felt like back then if I had been cherished and cradled. Acquiring a sensory experience of feeling treasured and protected as a 3-year-old in the trance-like container of a structure allows people to re-script their inner experience, as in, I can spontaneously interact with other people without having to be afraid of being rejected or getting hurt. Structures harness the extraordinary power of the imagination to transform the inner narratives that drive and confine our functioning in the world. With the proper support, the secrets that once were too dangerous to be revealed can be disclosed not just to a therapist, a latter-day father confessor, but, in our imagination, to the people who actually hurt and betrayed us. The three-dimensional nature of the structure transforms the hidden, the forbidden, and the fear into visible, concrete reality. In this, it is somewhat similar to IFS, which we explored in the previous chapter. IFS calls forth the split-off parts that you create in order to survive and enables you to identify and talk with them so that your undamaged self can emerge. In contrast, a structure creates a three-dimensional image of whom and what you had to deal with and gives you a chance to create a different outcome. Most people are hesitant to go into past pain and disappointment. It only promises to bring back the intolerable. But as they are mirrored and witnessed, a new reality begins to take shape. Accurate mirroring feels completely different from being ignored, criticized, and put down. It gives you permission to feel what you feel and know what you know, one of the essential foundations of recovery. Trauma causes people to remain stuck in interpreting the present in light of an unchanging past. The scene you recreate in a structure may or may not be precisely what happened, but it represents the structure of your inner world, your internal map, and the hidden rules that you have been living by. Daring to tell the truth. I recently led another group structure with a 26-year-old man named Mark, who at age 13 had accidentally overheard his father having phone sex with his aunt, his mother's sister. Mark felt confused, embarrassed, hurt, betrayed, and paralyzed by this knowledge. And when he tried to talk with his father about it, he was met with rage and denial. He was told that he had a filthy imagination and was accused of trying to break up the family. Mark never dared to tell his mom, but henceforth the family secrets and hypocrisy contaminated every aspect of his home life and gave him a pervasive sense that nobody could be trusted. After school, he spent his isolated adolescence hanging around neighborhood basketball courts or in his room watching TV. When he was 21, his mother died of a broken heart, Mark says, and his father married the aunt. Mark was not invited to either the funeral or the wedding. Secrets like these become inner toxins, realities that you are not allowed to acknowledge to yourself or to others, but that nevertheless become the template of your life. I knew none of this history when Mark joined the group, but he stood out by his emotional distance, and during check-ins, he acknowledged that he felt separated from everyone by a dense fog. I was quite worried about what would be revealed once we started to look behind his frozen, expressionless exterior. When I invited Mark to talk about his family, he said a few words and then seemed to shut down even more. So I encouraged him to ask for a contact figure to support him. He chose a white-haired group member, Richard, and placed Richard on a pillow next to him, touching his shoulder. Then, as he began to tell his story, Mark placed Joe, as his real father, 10 feet in front of him, and directed Carolyn, representing his mother, to crouch in a corner with her face hidden. Mark next asked Amanda to play his aunt, telling her to stand defiantly to one side, arms crossed over her chest, representing all the calculating, ruthless, and devious women who were after men. Surveying the tableau he had created, Mark sat up straight, eyes wide open. Clearly the fog had lifted. I said, "A witness can see how startled you are, seeing what you had to deal with. Mark nodded appreciatively and remained silent and somber for some time. Then, looking at his father, he burst out, "You asshole! You hypocrite! You ruined my life!" I invited Mark to tell his father all the things that he wanted to tell him but never could. A long list of accusations followed. I directed the father to respond physically as if he had been punched, so that Mark could see that his blows had landed. It did not surprise me when Mark spontaneously said that he'd always worried that his rage would get out of control, and that this fear had kept him from standing up for himself in school, at work, and in other relationships. After Mark had confronted his father, I asked if he would like Richard to assume a new role, that of his ideal father. I instructed Richard to look Mark directly in the eye and to say, "If I had been your ideal father back then, I would have listened to you and not accused you of having a filthy imagination." When Richard repeated this, Mark started to tremble. "Oh my God, life would have been so different if I could have trusted my father and talked about what was going on. I could have had a father." I then told Richard to say, "If I had been your ideal father back then, I would have welcomed your anger, and you would have had a father you could have trusted." Mark visibly relaxed and said that would have made all the difference in the world. Then, Mark addressed the stand-in for his aunt. The group was visibly stunned as he unleashed a torrent of abuse on her. "You conniving whore! You backstabber! You betrayed your sister and ruined her life! You ruined our family!" After he was done, Mark started to sob. He then said he'd always been deeply suspicious of any woman who showed an interest in him. The remainder of the structure took another half hour, in which we slowly set up conditions for him to create two new women. The ideal aunt who did not betray her sister, but who helped support their isolated immigrant family, and the ideal mother who kept her husband's interest and devotion, and so did not die of heartbreak. Mark ended the structure quietly surveying the scene he had created with a contented smile on his face. For the remainder of the workshop, Mark was an open and valuable member of the group, and 3 months later he sent me an email saying that this experience had changed his life. He had recently moved in with his first girlfriend, and although they had some heated discussions about their new arrangement, he'd been able to take in her point of view without clamming up defensively, going back to his fear or rage, or feeling that she was trying to pull a fast one. He was amazed that he felt okay disagreeing with her, and that he was able to stand up for himself. He then asked for the name of a therapist in his community to help with the huge changes he was making in his life, and I fortunately had a colleague I could refer him to. Antidotes to Painful Memories. Like the model mugging classes that I discussed in Chapter 13, the structures in psychomotor therapy hold out the possibility of forming virtual memories that live side by side with the painful realities of the past and provide sensory experiences of feeling seen, cradled, and supported that can serve as antidotes to memories of hurt and betrayal. In order to change, people need to become viscerally familiar with realities that directly contradict the static feelings of the frozen or panicked self of trauma, replacing them with sensations rooted in safety, mastery, delight, and connection. As we saw in the chapter on EMDR, one of the functions of dreaming is to create associations in which the frustrating events of the day are interwoven with the rest of one's life. Unlike our dreams, psychomotor structures are still subject to the laws of physics, but they, too, can reweave the past. Of course, we can never undo what happened, but we can create new emotional scenarios, intense and real enough, to diffuse and counter some of those old ones. The healing tableaus of structures offer an experience that many participants have never believed was possible for them. To be welcomed into a world where people delight in them, protect them, meet their needs, and make you feel at home. Chapter 19. Rewiring the Brain. neurofeedback. Is it a fact